The area is nearly filled. Some of the women have showered and made themselves up. Some of them have not. And they have divided themselves up according to socioeconomic class. The rich sit with the rich, the middle with the middle, the poor with the poor. There are more rich than middle, more middle than poor. The rich women talk and laugh and hardly touch their food, and they behave as if they are on some sort of vacation. The middle women are less animated, but they also look as if they're enjoying themselves. The poor women are not made up at all, and they hardly talk. They concentrate on their food, as if these are the best meals they have seen, and the best meals they are going to see. Although my table is empty, most of the tables in the men's area are filled. The divisions among the men are not made by class, but by drug of choice. Drunks sit together. Cokeheads sit together, crackheads sit together, junkies sit together, pill poppers sit together. Within each of these groups, there are two other divisions. One group is made up of the hardcore. They are the heaviest users and the truly fucked up. The other group is made up of the wussies. They are the functional and the potentially saved. The hardcore make fun of the wussies and tell them they don't belong here. The wussies don't respond with words, but with looks that say, "Thank God I'm not one of you." Ed and Ted and John sit among the hardcore. Roy and his friend and Warren and the bald man sit with the wussies. I sit alone watching them all, wondering what the fuck I am doing here, desperately wishing I had something that would fuck me up. The food has killed the instinct for the moment, but I know it will come back. And I know it will come back stronger. Get something hard, and get something fast. Fill me till I die. Leonard sits down at my table. He is wearing a different Rolex and a different Hawaiian shirt. His plate is covered with sausage and bacon and nothing else. "Hey, kid." He unfolds a napkin, places it on his lap. "Hi." He takes another napkin, and he cleans his knife, his fork, and the edge of the glass of orange juice. "When'd you get the teeth?"
"Yesterday."
"What did they have to do?"
"Cap the outside, too. Fill a cavity on this one."
I point to my outside left tooth.
"Root canals on these."
I tap the middle two. They are firm.
"They give you good drugs?"
"They didn't give me anything."
"No fucking way."
"Yeah."
"They didn't give you anything?"
"No."
"You got root canals on your two front teeth without any drugs?"
"Yeah." Leonard looks at me as if what I have said is incomprehensible to him.
"That's the worst fucking thing I've ever heard."
"It sucked."
"Sucked isn't the word I would use."
"It fucking sucked." He laughs, sets down his fork.
"Where the fuck did they make you, kid?"
"What's that mean?"
"Where does someone like you come from?"
"I've lived a lot of places."
"Like where?"
"Why do you care?"
"Just wondering."
"Stop wondering."
"Why?"
"I don't want to make friends here."
"Why?"
"I don't like goodbyes."
"You gotta say them, though."
"No, you don't." I stand, and I take my tray. And I get back in line, and I get more food, and I get more napkins. And I make my way toward an empty table in the corner, and I sit down, and I eat my food. I eat slower this time. With each bite I take, I feel my stomach expanding. It is an awful, uncomfortable feeling, but I can't stop. I take bite after bite. I feel worse and worse. I look at the food, and I don't want any more, but it doesn't matter. I take bite after bite. I feel worse and worse. Get something. Fill me. That is all that matters. Fill me. I finish the plate and I stand, and I walk slowly, slowly, slowly across the dining room, and I put my tray on the conveyor belt to the dishwasher. When I turn around, Lily is standing in front of me. Although I saw her a little while ago, I didn't really see her. And although I have met her twice before, I have never really looked at her. She has long black hair to the middle of her chest, and she has blue eyes. Not ice blue, water blue. Deep, clean water blue.
She is pale white, pale, pale, pale white, and her lips are thick and blood red, though she is not wearing lipstick. Her jeans are old and worn, and her black sweater is old and worn, and her combat boots are old and worn, and everything is too big for her body, which is small and thin. She is holding a tray and smiling. Her teeth are straight and white, and they are straight in a way that came without braces, and white in a way that has nothing to do with toothpaste. I smile back. She speaks.
You have teeth?
Yeah.
They look nice.
Thanks.
You doing all right?
Not even close. You?
Yeah, I'm okay.
Good. I step around her, and I walk away. I know she is watching me, but I don't look back. I make my way through the halls, and I go to the lecture hall, and I find a seat among the men of my unit, and I sit down. Leonard sits next to me, and I get up, and I move, so that there is a seat between us. He looks at me, and he laughs. I ignore him. The lecture starts. It is about letting go and letting God. The man giving the lecture has been sober for a decade. Whenever he is troubled or something is going wrong in his life, he turns it over to God and goes to an AA meeting. God does with it what he will, resolving it for better or for worse, and the man doesn't worry about it or try to control it. He just waits and trusts, waits and goes to meetings, waits and assumes whatever happens is what is supposed to happen. When he talks of God and of his trust in his mighty male God, his eyes glaze over. It is a glaze I know, and have seen many times before, usually when someone is fucked out of their skull on strong, hard drugs. His God has become his drug, and he is high, high as a motherfucking kite. And he rants and raves, paces back and forth, God this and God that, blah, blah, blah. If I was closer to him, or if I could get at him, I would punch him in the mouth just to make him shut the fuck up. He finishes, and everyone is impressed, and everyone claps. I get up and I leave. When I get outside the door, Ken is waiting for me.
Hi, James.
Hi.
Could you come with me for a little while?
Why?
Your test results have come back, and Dr. Baker wants to speak with you.
Okay. We walk back through the light of the halls, and it makes me uncomfortable, and Ken tries to make small talk, and I ignore him. I ignore him because my need to get fucked up is growing, and it is screaming at me, and it is all I can think about and all I can concentrate on. I would kill for a drink right now. Kill. Drink. Kill. Drink. Kill. We walk into the medical unit, and Ken takes me to the waiting room, and he tells me to wait. He leaves, and I smoke a cigarette, and I watch television. The cigarette tastes good, and it burns my throat and my lungs, and though it is the lowest and weakest drug that I am addicted to, it is still a drug, and it feels fucking good. I don't care what it's doing to me. It feels fucking good. There is a coffee machine in the corner, and I get up and I get myself a cup. I pour sugar into it to the point of saturation, and I take a sip, and it is hot, and it hurts to drink it, and I like it. My heart speeds up almost immediately. And though it doesn't speed up like it normally does, and though I am not addicted to coffee, it is still a drug. And it feels fucking good. It feels so fucking good. Ken comes back to the room, and he says the doctor is ready. And I stand, and he leads me through the medical unit to a small, clean, white examination room. There are three chairs and a window, and a set of shiny steel shelves with instruments on them, and an examination table against one of the walls, and an X-ray viewing machine hanging near the door. Dr. Baker is sitting in one of the chairs with a file. He stands when we enter.
Hi, James.
He offers his hand. I shake it. Hello, Dr. Baker. We sit.
Can I see your teeth?
I smile.
They look good. Dr. Stevens said you were very brave.
Dr. Stevens was good to me. Thank him for me next time you speak to him.
I will.
Now, tell me why I'm here. Dr. Baker opens his file. I have the results from the tests we took a few days ago.
How bad is it?
He looks at the file. He takes a deep breath. He leans back in his chair and he looks at me. He speaks.
You have done significant damage to your nose, your throat, your lungs, your stomach, your bladder, your kidneys, your liver, and your heart. I have never seen so much and such extensive damage in someone so young. We would need to do more tests to know the specific extent of it, and if you want them done, we can facilitate that. But from what I have here, I know a few important things. The first is that you are lucky to be alive. The second is that if you ever have another drink or use any type of hard drug again, there is a good chance that you will die. The third is that if you start drinking or using drugs regularly, you will be dead within a few days. Your body has suffered from a pattern of such profound and prolonged abuse that it will not hold up anymore. Ken is staring at me. Dr. Baker is staring at me. I look past him and out the window where the storm is still raging. I finally know, with absolute certainty, what I have suspected for a long time. I am almost dead.
It's a happy fucking day.
Dr. Baker speaks.
This is not a joking matter, James.
I look at him.
I know it's not, but what the fuck am I supposed to say? I have received my sentence.
Ken speaks.
What's that mean?
What do you think it means?
We're here to help you, James. We're here to help you get better and to help you learn how to stop killing yourself. If you do what we tell you to do and you follow the program we prescribe, you will live a long and happy life.
I have received my sentence.
It doesn't have to be carried out. Just trust us.
I look at Dr. Baker. You got anything else to say to me?
I hope you'll trust us. I hope you'll give us a chance to help you. And I hope to God you're here tomorrow.
I stare at him. His eyes are thick and wet and breaking. He is obviously sad and obviously disappointed. I'm tired of making people sad, and I'm tired of disappointing them, and I'm tired of seeing them break. I have seen this too many times. He will be the last. I appreciate your time and your efforts, both of you. Thank you. I stand, and I open the door, and I walk out of the room, and I shut the door behind me, and I head back to my room. Although I have just been told that further use of alcohol and drugs is going to kill me, and kill me soon, what I want right now is a nice strong drink and a blast of rock. I want them badly. Get something. I want them so badly. Fill me. I would kill for them. Get something. Kill for them. Fill me. I am completely fucked. All around me, people are going about their day. Patients are going to counseling and to therapy. Doctors and therapists are giving them whatever they need. People are either getting help or giving help, and they are all doing it willingly. Their bodies are recovering and their minds are recovering, and they are rebuilding their lives, and they are following the program, and they are trusting in the program. They have turned themselves over, and they believe, and whether it works or not in the long run doesn't matter. For now, they believe. I do not know how they are doing it. I get to my room and I see that someone has retrieved the Bible and the big book that I threw out the window, and placed them back on my bed. They're soggy and wet. The page is swollen, the covers warped. The fact that they are back, and that someone has brought them back, makes me angry. I pick them up and I carry them to the bathroom, and I stuff them in the garbage can beneath the used razors, the brown Q-tips, and the dirty snot rags. If I could, and if my body would cooperate, I would stuff them into the toilet and I would shit on them. I walk back to my bed and I lie down and I close my eyes, and the finality of Dr. Baker's words start to sink in, and the words clear my mind and kill my urges and slow my heart. I have received my sentence.
A few days of regular drug and alcohol abuse is going to kill me. I will be dead, gone, no more. I will cease to exist in any way, shape, or form. I will meet the blackness, and the blackness will be eternal. Somehow, I always knew I would meet my end this way. Somehow, I always knew that I would kill myself with drugs and alcohol. I knew each time I took a drink. I knew each time I snorted a line. I knew each time I hit a pipe or sniffed a tube or took a pill. It is nobody's fault but my own. I knew each and every time. I could never stop. I can imagine my obituary. The truth of my existence will be removed and replaced with imagined good. The reality of how I lived will be avoided and changed, and phrases will be dropped in like, beloved son, loving brother, reliable friend, hard-working student. People will change their view of me from reckless fuck-up to helpless martyr, from dangerous fool to sad victim, from addicted asshole to unfortunate child. They will say things like, my God, what a waste! Oh, what he could have been. He had so much going for him. What happened? And it will be fucking false. Every single word of it will be false. I know who I am, and I know what I've done, and I know why I am about to die. I have faced the reality, and the reality is simple. I am an alcoholic, and I am a drug addict, and I am a criminal. That is what I am, and who I am, and that is how I should be remembered. No happy lies, no invented memories, no fake sentimentality, no tears. I do not deserve tears. I deserve to be portrayed honestly, and I deserve nothing more, and I start to write an honest obituary in my own mind. I write the obituary that should appear, but never will. I start at the beginning, and I stick to the facts, and I move to what I know will be my end. James Fry. Born in Cleveland, Ohio, September 12, 1969. Started stealing sips from drinks at 7. Got hammered for the first time at 10. Vomited from abuse for the first time at 10. Smoked dope at 12. By 13 was smoking and drinking regularly. Blacked out for the first time at 14. At 15 got arrested 3 times. For driving without a license, for vandalism and destruction of property, for public intoxication and possession of alcohol as a minor. Went to jail for a night. At 15, tried cocaine, acid, and crystal meth for the first time. Got arrested 3 more times at 16. Started drinking and doing drugs before school. Started selling liquor and drugs to his fellow students. Blacked out and vomited regularly. 3 more arrests at 17. Got first DUI. Blew a 36 and set a county record. Went to jail for a week. Drank and did drugs every day. At school, at home, everywhere. Vomited and blacked out several times a week. Made first attempt to quit. Experienced delirium tremens. Drank to make them go away. 2 arrests at 18. First drug overdose. First case of alcohol poisoning. Tried to quit again. Lasted 2 days. Vomited blood for the first time. Had first cocaine-induced bloody nose. 19. Blacked out 5 days a week. Vomited 5 days a week. Pissed bed for the first time. Shook visibly when not drinking. Woke up for the first time without knowing where he was or how he got there. 20. Blacked out 7 days a week. Vomited several times a day, 7 days a week. Smoked cocaine for the first time. Smoked methamphetamine for the first time. Smoked PCP for the first time. 21. 3 arrests. Assault with a deadly weapon. Assaulting an officer of the law. Felony DUI. Resisting arrest. Attempted incitement of a riot. Possession of a narcotic with intent to distribute. Felony mayhem. Skipped bail on everything. Smoked crack for the first time. Started smoking crack regularly. 1 overdose. 3 cases of alcohol poisoning. 22. Accelerated alcohol abuse, accelerated crack abuse. Took anything and everything possible, whenever possible. Was constantly sick, vomiting and shitting blood daily. Tried to quit 4 times. Never lasted longer than 12 hours. 23. Continued acceleration of abuse, continued decline in health. Two overdoses, constant alcohol poisoning. Rarely knew where he was or how he got there. Tried to quit twice, lasted a total of 6 hours. Fell down fire escape and destroyed face. Checked into treatment center, left treatment center, died 2 days later. Fatal dosage levels of alcohol and cocaine found in system. Death ruled accidental overdose. Should have been ruled suicide. Intentional suicide. He is survived by no one. His family had written him off. His friends had written him off. My mind is clear, and my urges are gone, and my heart is beating slow and steady. In my mind, my obituary is done. It is done, and it is right. It tells the truth, and as awful as it can be, the truth is what matters. It is what I should be remembered by, if I am remembered at all. Remember the truth. It is all that matters. My mind is clear, and my urges are gone, and my heart is beating slow and steady. I have made my decision, and I am comfortable with my decision. It's what I always knew would happen, though the details are just now coming into focus. I am going to leave here, and I am going to kill myself. I am going to leave here, and I am going to find something to drink, and I am going to find something to smoke, and I am going to drink and smoke until I die. I am going to leave here, and I'm not going to look back, and I'm not going to say goodbye. I have lived alone. I have fought alone. I have dealt with pain alone. I will die alone. I think about when I'm going to leave. I don't want to be seen, and I don't want to be followed. I want to disappear quickly and quietly and without any drama. I want as much time in the darkness as I can possibly have. The darkness provides cover. The darkness provides places to hide. And the darkness provides comfort. Darkness usually comes around dinner, but dinner would be too obvious. We are required to show up, and we are required to eat, and though I don't fraternize during dinner, it would be noticed if I were gone. The lecture follows, and the lecture would be better. People get up and leave during lectures all the time. They get up and go to the bathroom, head outside for a smoke, leave to meet with a counselor or a shrink, run to get sick. It would not be noticed if I left, and by the time anyone realized I was gone, which would probably be 3 or 4 hours later, I would be far enough away that there would be no bringing me back. I would be in the darkness. I would be alone. I would be comfortable. There would be no bringing me back. My mind is clear, and my urges are gone, and my heart is beating slow and steady. I am going to leave here. And I am going to kill myself. The thought makes me smile. It makes me smile because it is sad and horrible. It makes me smile because the mystery of my death is gone, and without the mystery, it isn't scary anymore. It makes me smile because I would rather smile than cry. It makes me smile because it's going to be over. It is finally going to be over. It is finally going to be over. Thank you. I take a deep breath, and I wonder how many breaths I have left. I feel my heart beat, and I wonder how many more. I run my hands along my body, and my body is warm and soft, and I know that soon it will be cold and hard. I feel my hair, my eyes, my nose, my lips. I feel the whiskers growing on my cheeks. I touch the skin on my neck, my chest, my arms. It will all be rotting soon. Decomposing and disintegrating, disappearing. Every trace will cease to exist. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. We return from which we came. I will be rotting and decomposing and disintegrating soon. I hear the door open and I sit up. Roy and Lincoln walk in. Roy is smirking and Lincoln looks pissed. Lincoln speaks. What are you doing?
Sitting here.
Why aren't you in group?
I needed some time alone.
You should have told somebody.
I didn't feel like telling anybody.
Things here aren't always about what you feel like doing.
If you're here to bitch at me about group, I'll go right now. If you're here to bitch about something else, let's get it over with.
Lincoln turns to Roy.
Roy?
Roy steps forward.
You didn't clean the group toilets this morning.
I laugh. Roy looks at Lincoln.
Lincoln speaks.
What's so funny?
His dumbass attempt to get me in trouble.
Roy speaks.
I'm not attempting anything. You didn't clean the group toilets this morning.
I laugh again.
Fuck you, Roy.
Roy looks at Lincoln. Lincoln looks at me.
They're not clean, James. He just showed them to me.
I look at him.
I cleaned them at about 4 o'clock this morning. Cleaned them till they fucking sparkled. If they're dirty now, it's because somebody used them, or somebody, most likely him, fucked them up to get me in trouble.
Roy speaks.
Not true.
I laugh.
Fuck you, Roy.
He turns to Lincoln, whines like a spoiled little boy.
It's not true.
Lincoln speaks.
Whether they were clean earlier is irrelevant. It's your job to keep them clean all the time, and right now they're dirty as hell. You need to go clean them again.
No way.
Absolutely yes.
No fucking way.
Right now.
You're fucking crazy if you think I'm going to touch those toilets. I cleaned them earlier, and Roy fucked them up to get me in trouble. Let Roy clean the goddamn things this time.
Lincoln steps forward. I lean against the back of the bed. He looms over me, puts on his fighting face.
You're going to clean them whether you want to or not, and you're going to do it right now, and you're not going to say another word about it. You understand me?
I push myself off the bed, and I stand, and I stare him in the eye.
You gonna force me?
I stare him in the eye.
You gonna try to force me?
I stare him in the eye.
Come on, Lincoln. What are you gonna do?
We stare at each other, breathe slow, clench our jaws, wait for a jump. I know nothing is going to happen, and that gives me the advantage. I know that if he touches me, he'll lose his job. I know the job is too important to him to risk for me. I know he's gotten soft after years of sobriety, and I know that at this point, the black clothes and the boots and the haircut are little more than a costume. I know nothing is going to happen, and that he has taken this so far is humorous to me. I laugh in his face. He speaks.
This is not a laughing matter.
I laugh again.
I'm not cleaning your fucking toilets, tough guy. No fucking way.
I step around him.
James!
I start to leave.
No fucking way!
I walk past Roy, and I walk out of the room, and I go to the upper level of the unit, and I drink a cup of coffee, and I smoke a couple of cigarettes, and the nicotine and the caffeine feel good inside of me. They speed up my heart. Slow down my brain, settle my hands, jump-start my feet. They are strong enough so that I can feel their effects, but not strong enough to really do anything significant. I like them, and I like the combination they form. One speedy and manic, the other slow and depressing. They ebb and flow so that I experience them on both ends of the spectrum. Fast as I can go, low as I can go, everything in between. It's fun playing with the doses and the levels, and it's fun manipulating the buzz. It's like firing a gun at a target. I get the feeling, and I get the rush, and I get the experience. But there's no danger. I am in complete control of what I'm doing and what I'm feeling. As in a gunfight, I know that when I switch to the real thing, there will be no controlling anything. No fucking way. As much as I can, as fast as I can. Till I die. Men begin filing in from their groups and heading to the dining hall for lunch. I follow them and I eat with Leonard. He asks me a lot of questions and I don't answer any of them. He thinks it's funny, and I think it's funny, and at a certain point he gives up and he tells me stories about our fellow patients. They're all the same. Had it all, got fucked up, lost it all. Trying to recover. The Great American Sob Story. After lunch, we go to the lecture, which is about exercise and sobriety. I don't listen to a single word of it. Don't care one fucking bit. And Leonard throws pennies at the bald man, who is now my roommate. He aims for his head, and he gets excited when he hits the center of the bald spot on the top of the man's skull.
For some reason, the man tolerates it. The lecture ends, and we go back to the unit, and I attend my first group therapy session. The topic is amends. The group is led by Ken, and they discuss the necessity of making amends. Ken believes they are imperative, as do most of the men in the group. Making them allows one to start with a clean slate, to get rid of the guilt addicts accrue with their actions, to shed the skin of their previous life. Whether they are accepted or not isn't important. What is important is the act of apologizing, the act of admitting fault, the act of asking for forgiveness. The men who don't believe in amends are the worst of the group. They know that most of what they have done shouldn't be forgiven and won't be forgiven. They don't want to make the effort of asking because the pain of rejection and the reminder of their actions will hurt too much. They want to move on and forget, even though forgetting is impossible. I am in their class. I know I won't be forgiven, and I'm not going to bother to ask. My amends will be my death. No one I have hurt will ever have to see me, hear from me, or think about me ever again. I won't be able to damage them or fuck up their lives anymore. I won't be able to cause them the pain I have caused previously. Forget me if you can. Forget I ever existed. Forget I did whatever it was I did. My suicide will be my apology. Even though it is impossible, please forget me. Please forget. After the group, all of the men of the unit gather in the lower level, and there is a graduation ceremony. Roy and his friend are both leaving. They have done their time, worked their programs, and they are ready to rejoin the outside world. They both receive a medal and a rock. The medal signifies their current term of sobriety. The rock, they resolve to stay sober. They both give small speeches. About half of the men despise them and think they're full of shit. The other half admire them and wish them the best. I sit in the back of the room with Leonard, who reads the USA Today sports page and swears under his breath. The ceremony ends and everybody claps, and Roy walks around giving out hugs and goodbyes. He avoids me, as does his friend. They both seem very happy, and they both have the glazed eyes of the converted. They clutch their medals and their rocks, have their friends sign the backs of their copies of the big book. They both look scared, and they both look fragile. They both look as if they're running from something, and they both look as if they're hiding from something. They both look as if they know they're going to get caught. I give them a month before they're both so fucked up that they can't see straight. I give them a month at best. Most of the men head to their rooms and start getting ready for dinner. I head to mine to get ready to leave. I take off Warren's Oxford and put on my T-shirt, and I write Warren a note of thanks, and I put it in the front pocket of the Oxford, and I walk over to his area, and I fold the Oxford, and I set it on his bed. I go back to my area, and I write another note that has Hank's name and the address of the clinic, and says, please return this jacket, and thank Hank for his kindness and friendship. I put this note in the front pocket of the jacket he lent me, so it will be found when I am found, and I put the jacket on, and I look around for anything else I might have, but there's nothing. I look in the drawers, on the bed, under the sheets, in the medicine cabinet, in the shower. There is nothing. I have nothing. I walk to the dining hall, and I get in line, and I grab a tray, and I take a deep breath, and the smell of the food floods my body, and I am hungry, 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 and I want to eat, and I want to eat a lot. Tonight's meal is meatloaf and mashed potatoes and gravy, and Brussels sprouts and apple pie. It is a meal I like, and it is suitable for what will probably be the last real meal that I eat. I get as much as the woman behind the counter will give me, and I get utensils and napkins, and I find an empty table, and I sit down and I spread the napkins on my lap, and I take a deep breath. This is probably going to be the last real meal I ever eat. The meatloaf is good and wet and juicy, and the potatoes are real potatoes, and the gravy is warm and thick and tastes deeply of beef. I eat slowly, savoring each bite, letting each bite sit in my mouth until it dissolves. My mother made meatloaf for my brother and me when I was a child, made this exact meal about once a week. Eating it now and eating it as my last meal brings back the memories of those dinners and of many more. My father would be working or away somewhere on some trip. My brother and I would be at school or running around whatever neighborhood we happened to live in at the time. At 6:30 every night, we'd have dinner with my mother. She made great dinners, and she loved the routine of sitting down and eating with us. After dinner, we'd watch television or play games, or my mother would read to us. When my father made it home, we would spend time together as a whole, and then it was off to bed for my brother and me. We were a family, a happy family, and we stayed that way until I stopped showing up. It would be nice to have my family here with me now. It would be nice, despite the disintegration of our relationship over the past years, to have a final dinner with them, though I doubt we would talk much. It would be nice to look each of them in the eye and say goodbye to them, though I doubt we would talk much. It would be nice to hold each of their hands, tell them that I'm sorry, that me being who I am wasn't their fault, though I doubt we would talk much. I would like to tell them to forget me. I finish eating, and I lean back in my chair, and I see Leonard walking toward me with a tray of food. He sets down his tray on the table, and he sits across from me, and he starts unfolding napkins and cleaning his silverware.
How are you, kid?
I'm good.
You're good?
Yeah, I'm good.
That's the first time I ever heard you say that.
I'm coming to terms with some shit.
What?
None of your business.
One of these days, you're going to talk to me.
No, I'm not.
You'll get tired of being an asshole, and you'll get tired of not having any friends, and you'll talk to me.
No, I won't.
I'm going to keep sitting with you until you do. I laugh. I'm going to keep sitting with you. Mark my motherfucking words.
I grab my tray. Stand. Have a nice life, Leonard.
What's that supposed to mean?
Have a nice life.
I turn, and I walk my tray to the conveyor, and I drop it on the belt, and I start to walk out of the dining hall. As I head through the glass corridor separating the men and women, I see Lily sitting alone at a table. She looks up at me and she smiles, and our eyes meet, and I smile back. She looks down, and I stop walking, and I stare at her. She looks up, and she smiles again. She is as beautiful a girl as I have ever seen. Her eyes, her lips, her teeth, her hair, her skin, the black circles beneath her eyes, the scars I can see in her wrists, the ridiculous clothes she wears that are 10 sizes too big, the sense of sadness and pain she wears that is even bigger. I stand and I stare at her, just stare, stare, stare. Men walk past me and other women look at me, and Lily doesn't understand what I'm doing or why I'm doing it, and she's blushing and it's beautiful. I stand there and I stare. I stare because I know where I am going. I'm not going to see any beauty. They don't sell crack in mansions or fancy department stores. And you don't go to luxury hotels or country clubs to smoke it. Strong, cheap liquor isn't served in 5-star restaurants or champagne bars, and it isn't sold in gourmet groceries or boutique liquor stores. I'm going to go to a horrible place in a horrible neighborhood, run by horrible people, providing product for the worst society has to offer. There will be no beauty there, nothing even resembling beauty. There will be dealers and addicts, and criminals and whores and pimps and killers and slaves. There will be drugs and liquor and pipes and bottles and smoke and vomit and blood and human rot and human decay and human disintegration. I have spent much of my life in these places. When I leave here, I will find one of them, and I will stay there until I die. Before I do, however, I want one last look at something beautiful. I want one last look,
so that I have something to hold in my mind while I'm dying, so that when I take my last breath, I will be able to think of something that will make me smile, so that in the midst of the horror, I can hold on to some shred of humanity. A woman walks over to Lily, and she leans over, and she whispers something in her ear, and Lily shakes her head and she shrugs. The woman looks as if she has some sort of authority, and I don't want to get Lily in trouble because of what I want. So I wait until she looks back at me, and I smile, and she smiles a beautiful, perfect smile back, and I have the image I want. Goodbye, Lily. I will hold your image dear. Goodbye, and thank you. I walk to the lecture, and I find a seat in the back row of the lecture hall, and I sit down and I stare straight ahead, and I ignore everything and everyone around me. In 15 minutes I'll be out of here, gone for good on a beeline to hell. In the simplest terms, what I'm doing shouldn't be hard. Stand up, walk out, keep walking. The abstract, however, is starting to sink in. The abstract is starting to sink in, and it is starting to make this harder for me. I am going to die. When I die, I will be dead, gone, no more. There will be no more thinking, no more breathing, no more feeling of any kind. There will be blackness, and the blackness will be eternal. There will be silence, and the silence will last forever. I am going to die. I take a deep breath. I am doing the right thing. I am doing the right thing. I am doing the right thing. It is time to end this charade. It is time for me to leave. I can't take my life anymore. I can't take myself anymore. I can't look into my own eyes. I can't bear to face my own image. I have tried to get better, and I can't. It is time for me to die. Leonard sits down next to me, and he stares at me. I stare straight ahead.
Why are you wearing that big coat?
I ignore him.
You cold?
I ignore him.
Why are you wearing that big coat?
He stares.
Talk to me, you little fucker.
I stare straight ahead.
Why are you wearing that big coat?
I ignore him. He reaches for me, and he puts his hand on my shoulder, and he shakes me.
Why'd you tell me to have a nice life?
I remove his hand from my shoulder, and I forcefully set it in his lap, and I turn, and I look him in the eye.
Leave me the fuck alone.
He looks back, right in my eye.
Why'd you tell me to have a nice life? Leave me alone, old man. Leave me the fuck alone.
I turn away from him, and I stare straight ahead. I can feel him continue to stare at me. I don't know why he's doing this, or why he cares, or what he thinks it is going to achieve. If he tries to stop me, I will prevent him from doing so, and I will leave anyway. It is time for me to die. The lecture starts, and he turns away from me. On the stage, a man about my own age starts telling his life story. He drank some beer and smoked some pot as a kid, and got sober when he was 14. He joined AA, and he found a higher power, and it changed his life. He got straight A's in high school, and he went to Harvard. Now he's an investment banker, and he's engaged to be married. He still goes to meetings, places all of his trust in his higher power, and he gets down on his knees every night, and he prays before he goes to bed. As he speaks of his nefarious past, he refers to pot as grass and beer as brew. He talks about having the spins and taking sips from a flask at a school dance. He talks about the guilt and shame he felt in committing these acts. I do not relate to this man in any way whatsoever. I do not relate to drinking brew and smoking grass and the spins and sips from a flask. I do not connect these things to any sort of true and dangerous addiction. I do not connect these things to any sort of need for recovery. I suspect that this man would have joined a 12-step group had he felt he had been watching too much television, or eating too many hot dogs, or playing too much Space Invaders, or picking his goddamn nose too many times a day. I suspect that had he not found the 12 steps,
He would have found the Jehovah's Witnesses, or the Pentecostal Christians, or the Hasidim, or the UFO Redemption Group. I suspect that his membership in AA doesn't have anything to do with brew and grass, or any sort of addiction to them, but to a desperate need to belong to something. Belonging is not something I have ever concerned myself with, and is not something I give two shits about. I have lived alone. I am about to die alone. I stand and I start to make my way out of the aisle. As I pass Leonard, he reaches for my arm. I push his hand away, and I keep going, past the rest of the seated men, toward the door, out and into a hall toward another door that leads outside. I reach the door, and I open it, and I am hit by the cold and the rain and the wind and the sleet, and I am hit by the darkness, and I am hit by what lives within the darkness. I button up the jacket, and I flip the collar, and I take a deep breath and I stare into the black. They are waiting for me. The drink and the drugs, and the dealers and the addicts, and the criminals and the whores, and the pimps and the killers and the slaves, and the pipes and the bottles, and the smoke, and the vomit, and the blood, and the human rot, and the human decay, and the human disintegration. They are there in the darkness, and they are waiting for me. I step out from beneath the cover of the door, and I start walking. One step at a time, away, away, away. The cold is quick and bitter. The rain and sleet are hard and wet. The ground a mosaic of mud and rock and water. The darkness, the darkest darkness. Away, away, away. One step at a time. It is waiting for me. It is waiting for me. About 20 feet from the entrance, I hear the door open. And I turn around, and I see Leonard coming outside. He's not wearing a jacket, and he's immediately drenched, and he is heading straight toward me.
Hey, kid!
I turn away from him, and I keep walking. I hear his footsteps in the wetness, and I hear the pace of them increase, and I hear them getting closer to me. I keep walking.
Wait up a second, kid!
I don't wait, don't stop, don't turn around.
Where are you going?
Footsteps closer.
Where are you going?
A hand on my shoulder. I push it off.
Stop for a second, kid.
A hand on my shoulder. I push it off. Hands on both my shoulders. Stronger than I expected. They stop me and they turn me around. Leonard is drenched and dripping. He speaks.
Where are you going?
I push his arms off of me. Leave me alone. I start walking.
Where are you going?
He follows me.
Away from here. What are you going to do?
Get fucked up?
No way I'm letting that happen.
You think you're going to stop me?
Yeah.
I stop, turn around, grab him by the throat, squeeze his Adam's apple. I don't want him following me. Don't want him trying to stop me. I am in the darkest darkness. I am going home. Leave me alone, old man. I let go, push him to the ground. He grabs his throat, gags. I start walking, and the lights of the clinic start to fade, and the black begins to envelop me. I hear Leonard stand and start after me again, and I clench my fists and prepare to use more persuasive means to stop him.
I can see the fist, kid, and it's going to take a whole lot more than that to take me down.
I keep walking.
And even if you can take me down, I'll have you found and brought back here.
He follows.
And I'll keep doing it as many times as you leave and as many times as it takes to get your goddamn head on straight and make you start fixing yourself.
I keep walking.
You don't know me and you don't know who I am, but I have the resources and I'll fucking use them. I'll bring you back again and again and again.
I stop and I turn around. He's a few feet behind me. He stops, and he stares at me.
Again and again and again, kid. I'll keep doing it.
I told you to leave me alone.
Come back inside.
No.
Where are you going to go?
I'm going to go get fucked up.
And then what?
I'll see what happens.
You'll end up dead.
Maybe.
When you're dead, you're dead.
I know.
There's no coming back.
I know that. That's not what you want.
It's my only option.
No, it's not. He steps forward. One more step and I'll drop you. I'll get back up. No, you won't. What are you scared of, kid? Fuck you. He steps forward. What are you scared of? Take a step back, old man. He stares at me. I stare at him. He steps back and he speaks. I'm not scared of anyone, and you scare the shit out of me. Ed and Ted won't eat with me anymore, because they're worried that you might snap on them. And all day, all anybody talked about was how you stared Lincoln down and laughed in his face when he tried to get rough with you. As much as I admire it in a certain sense, it's no good being the way you are. It's no good at all. I am what I am. That's not what's inside of you. Fuck you. You can't fool me. Fuck you. You can't fool me. Fuck you. Fine, fuck me. Go find some booze and whatever else it is you do, and get fucked up and go die in the gutter with piss on your pants and shit in your drawers. That's a good way to go, kid. An honorable way out. Be proud. It's my choice. If you think you're making that choice, you're wrong. Your choices are made by the shit that controls you and by the shit you can't quit. You walk out of here and that shit's gonna kill you, and that's fucking wrong. Maybe, maybe not. Maybe not my ass. How about walking back in and being a fucking man? How about walking back in and putting up a fucking fight? How about walking back in and doing what's decent and right and honorable and showing a little pride, just a little bit of fucking pride? Not possible. Why? It's just not. You're strong enough to get your teeth drilled without drugs, and you're strong enough to scare the shit out of a bunch of hardened fuck-ups, and you're strong enough to do whatever the fuck you've had to do to end up like you are, and you can't walk back into that clinic and try? No. Why? I've tried before. I can't do it. Why? It's too hard. Life is hard, kid. You gotta be harder. You gotta take it on and fight for it and be a fucking man about how you live it. If you're too much of a pussy to do that, then maybe you should leave, 'cause you're dead already. I stare at him and he stares back. Unlike most of the eyes that look upon me, there is no pity in his, no sadness, no sense that he's looking at a lost cause. There is an anger, and there is a hardness, and there is a resolve. There is truth. And that is all that matters, the truth. I don't know why he's out here, or why he's doing this, but I know by his eyes that he means what he says, that he will follow through with his words. Why do you give a shit? Because I do. Why? It doesn't matter why. All that matters is that I'm here, and that I'm not going to accept any of your bullshit, or any of your excuses. You can make this easy and come back right now, or you can make this hard and make me call out my dogs. Either way, you're here till you get better. I can't promise that's gonna happen. Promise that you'll try. I stare at him. Trying can't hurt, kid. There is truth in his eyes. Truth is all that matters. And trying's nothing to be scared of. Truth. Just try. I take a deep breath. I stare at him. I am in the darkest darkness, and I am comfortable. Except for my time inside, I have been sober for a total of 4 days in the last 6 years. My attempts at sobriety were weak at best. There was always liquor around. There were always drugs around. I was always around people who were using them. I am profoundly, physically, mentally, and emotionally addicted to two separate substances. I am profoundly, physically, mentally, and emotionally addicted to a certain way of life. I don't know anything else anymore. I don't remember anything else anymore. I don't know if I can be anything else at this point. I am scared to try. I am fucking scared to death to try. I have considered my options to be in jail or death. I have never considered quitting to be an option, because I have never believed that I could do it. I am scared to death to try. I stare at Leonard. I don't know him. I don't know who he is or what he does or what he has done to arrive at this moment.
I don't know why he is here or why he has followed me, or why he gives a shit. What I know is in his eyes. What I know is an anger, a hardness, a resolve, and truth. What I know is that I respect his eyes, and I believe his eyes. What I know is that what's in his eyes is different from any of the other eyes that have looked at me, judged me, pitied me, and written me off over the last years. What I know is that I can trust his eyes because what lives in them lives in me. 24 hours. 24 hours what? I'll stay here for 24 hours. If I feel the same way I feel now, I'm gone. I'll call out my dogs. Call them. I'll bite their fucking heads off. He smiles.
You're a scary motherfucker, kid.
Don't forget it, old man. He laughs.
Come here. I'm going to give you a hug.
I stay where I am. I agreed to 24 hours. That doesn't mean I'm hugging you, and that doesn't mean we're friends. He laughs again, steps forward, puts his arms around me, hugs me.
All you got to do is try.
I pull away. He motions toward the faded lights of the clinic.
It's fucking cold out here, and I'm soaking wet, and I don't want to get sick. Let's go inside.
I'm not going back to that lecture.
I don't care if you do or you don't. As long as you're inside, I'm happy.
We walk back to the door, and I open it, and we go inside. The lights are bright, and I don't like them, and I am scared to death. I am scared to death. Scared to death. Scared. Fucking scared. I am outside. I am sitting on a wooden bench in back of the main building of the clinic. There are empty benches on either side of me. A small lake in front. I am cold and I am shaking, and there is sweat running down my forehead and my chest and my arms and my legs, and my heart is speeding up and slowing down, and my teeth are chattering, and my mouth is dry, and there are bugs in my coat and in my pants and in my shirt and in my shoes and in my socks. Even though I can see them and hear them and feel them, I know they're not really there. I'm cold. I can see the bugs, and I hear the bugs, and I feel the bugs, but I know they're not really there. I'm cold. I have not slept. Will not be sleeping anytime soon. I tried to sleep, and Warren was snoring, and the bald man was snoring, and John was moaning and turning and twitching and crying out in his dreams, and I was thinking about my decision to stay here for 24 more hours. My mind was fine with my decision, and my heart was fine with my decision, and my mind and my heart were ready to keep my word, but my body wasn't fine, or anywhere near fine, and it wasn't ready to keep anything. My body wanted drugs and alcohol. My body wanted large amounts of them. I stood, and I paced to the symphony of snores and moans and cries, in an attempt to wear my body down and make it fine. But it didn't work. My body wants what it wants, and it could give a fuck about 24 hours. I have 18 hours left. I am not wearing a watch, and I can't see a clock, but I know I have 18 hours left. I left my room, and I left the unit, and I went outside, and I walked around the buildings and the units a couple of times. The buildings and the units were dark and quiet, except for the medical unit. It was light, and there were screams coming from within it. I stood and listened to the screams, and I screamed back at them. I screamed as loud as I could scream. Nobody heard me, and nobody responded. I screamed as loud as I could, but nobody heard me. I found the bench, and I sat on it. And I have been sitting on it, and the wet wood has been soaking into the backs of my legs. I am staring at the lake. The surface is dark and smooth, and there are long, thin, fragile sheets of ice floating among dead leaves and broken sticks. It is the deepest part of night, just before the dawn, and the storm has broken, and the wind and the rain and the sleet are gone. I am staring into the lake, and I'm sweating, and my teeth are chattering, and my heart is speeding up and slowing down, and it hurts, and there are fucking bugs everywhere. There is nothing I can do that will make them go away. I am thinking about her, I am thinking about her even though I don't want to think about her. I am thinking about her because I can't forget her, because I continue to look back at her. She is the only one. I can't let go of what once was and what will never be again. I can't face the fact that she is gone, gone, gone. I can't face that it was me who drove her away. I was with her. I loved her. I drove her away. I am thinking about her, even though I don't want to think about her. 2 days after my first trip to her room, I went back. Before I arrived, I drank a bottle of wine and I smoked a pack of cigarettes, and I rehearsed what I would say when she opened the door. When I got to the door, I stood and stared at it. My heart was pounding and my hands were shaking, and I felt dizzy. I knocked, and a voice that wasn't her voice said, "Just a minute," and I stood, and I waited, nervous, scared, and the door opened, and a tall girl, with thick red lips and a big smile and brown hair and brown eyes, stood before me. It was not her.
"I was hoping you'd come back."
"Who are you?"
"Lucinda, Ed's friend. You want to come in?"
"Yeah." I stepped into a typical dorm room with two desks and two windows, and two used couches and stacks of papers and books, and a couple of pizza boxes and some empty beer cans and tapestries on the walls, and a stereo in the corner with a pile of CDs, and a loft with two beds looming over everything. As I looked around the room, I saw that she was reading a book in one of the beds. Light streamed through one of the windows and across her face, and I had never seen anything or anyone so beautiful in my life. If my heart had stopped at that moment, I would have fallen happy and fallen full, and I would have seen in life all that I had wanted to see and all that I needed to see. Fall. Let me fall. Lucinda opened a small fridge, and she pulled out a couple of beers.
"Want one?"
"No."
"Mind if I have one?"
"I don't care." Lucinda cracked one of the beers, and she of the eyes set her book down, and they both watched me as I reached into my pocket and pulled out a quarter bag of dope. It was good dope, the best I could get, and better than anything that was floating around the school. Green, hairy, and pungent, the odor was strong enough that it drifted through the clear plastic of the baggie. I tossed it to Lucinda.
"Where'd you get this?"
She opened the bag.
"A friend."
Took a deep breath.
"How much?"
Closed the bag. "Don't worry about it."
"No way."
"Yeah."
"Why?"
"I'm in a giving mood."
"Thank you."
"I'll give you a number. If you want more, call it and tell them you're my friend. They'll hook you up."
"Thank you."
"Don't give the number out. I normally don't do this, and they don't like people they don't know calling them."
"Okay."
Lucinda sat down on one of the couches and reached under it and pulled out some rolling papers and set them on her lap and started picking buds out of the bag.
"You want to smoke with us?"
I could feel her watching me from her loft. I was scared. "I don't smoke dope."
"Really?"
I stood.
"Really."
I opened the door.
"Bye." "Thank you."
I nodded, and as I closed the door, I looked up at her, and she was looking at me, and our eyes met, and she smiled, and I knew I wasn't the only one who was nervous and scared and whose hands had been shaking. I wanted to fall. I wanted to fall hard. I knew. Darkness retreats and the sun rises. Red, yellow, and orange creep into clear blue. The sweet airborne calls of waking birds echo across the black mirror of the lake. A crisp draft carries the bitter of cold into the reserve of night. I stand and I walk back to the unit, and the dew on the dead grass soaks through my shoes, and I watch my feet break the crystalline perfection of the morning's drops. And the drops are just another thing I've destroyed, another thing I can't fix or bring back. Another beautiful thing ruined by my carelessness. I don't stop. I don't stop destroying, and I don't change my course, and I don't look back. Looking back hurts too much, so I just keep going. I open the door, and I head inside. And it is quiet, and no one is awake yet. I walk to my room, and I go to the bathroom, and I take off my clothes, and I step into the shower, and I turn on the hot water. Same old bullshit. The water burns, and it turns my skin red, and it hurts, and it hurts, and it hurts, and I stand there, and I take it, because I deserve it, and because I don't know anything else. It hurts, and I deserve it. Same old bullshit. I step out, and I dry off, and I walk to the mirror, and I wipe the steam away, and I look at myself. The black beneath my eyes is fading. The swelling around my nose is gone, though the bump is there, and will stay there. The swelling in my lips is down, and my lips are starting to look almost normal. The reduced swelling in them makes the stitches around my gash more prominent. The stitches are old and black and crusty, and they look like barbed wire. The gash has sealed itself, and a scar is starting to form. I pull down my lower lip to look at the rest of the cuts and the rest of the stitches. The stitches are black, and they weave in and out of one another like a vicious fence. The cuts are closed bright white against pale red. They're no longer bleeding, no longer oozing, and scars are starting to form. I start to look up. I want to see my eyes. I want to look beneath the surface of the pale green and see what's inside of me. As I get near, I turn away. I try to force myself back, but I can't do it. I have not consciously looked into my eyes for years. Although I have wanted to look into them, I have not had the strength to do so. I try to force myself, but I can't. I do not have the strength now, and I do not know if I will ever have the strength. I might never look into the pale green of my eyes again. There are places from which you cannot return. There is damage that can be irreparable. I wrap a towel around my waist, and I walk into the room to see if anyone is awake. Warren is sitting up, and the bald man is sitting up, and they're talking to each other. John is still sleeping and is curled into the fetal position, and he is clutching himself and sucking his thumb. I walk over to Warren. Good morning.
Hi, James. How are you?
I'm okay.
You look tired.
Didn't sleep much.
He nods. It happens here.
I was wondering if I could borrow something from you.
What do you need?
A Swiss Army knife or some nail clippers or something sharp.
Why do you need something sharp?
I just do.
Are you going to hurt yourself?
I smile. If I was going to hurt myself, I'd use something that does a whole lot more damage than a Swiss Army knife or a pair of nail clippers.
He looks at me, smiles.
Yes, I guess you would.
He leans over and he opens his dresser, and he withdraws a pair of small, shiny nail clippers. He hands them to me.
Thanks, Warren.
I walk back to the bathroom. The steam has dissipated, and the mirror is clean. I walk over to it, and I look at the stitches around my gash. They are black and crusty, and they look like barbed wire. I want them gone. I am tired of looking like Frankenstein.